Hello, everybody. This is Laura.
And I'm Carolyn with Ranchers Have Rights.
And welcome to our podcast, Cow Dust and Cattle Country.
We have had a time getting together to make this third episode. It was supposed to be done a week ago, but the world kind of went crazy on us up at our different ranches. Laura, what happened to you?
Well, yeah, that was a lot of fun last week. We did our second podcast and we uploaded it. And we got it all done, and the very next day I had to take Miles in, and he had to have surgery. And all of that went really well until the middle of the night in a hotel room when he had to go back to the ER and be hospitalized for almost a week. So that took up my time.
We were just talking before we made this podcast that wouldn't it be something that if we could spend all our time focusing on our ranches, on taking care of our families and our businesses.
There's just so much to do. And I'm realizing that now that I've lost my muscle and he's laid up while he's recovering from this thing. And I'm just go. And I really couldn't even get together with Carolyn this week again after, I mean, it's been almost 2 weeks since the surgery and I'm still trying to find time to get everything done.
Right. And wouldn't it be something if the Forest Service was doing the fighting for us? Because that's the whole purpose we're doing these podcasts, is to get the history of the protection that the Forest Service said they would give to us. And so we kind of talked about Jim Chilton, and Laura knows more about that. Why don't you tell his story?
Well, you know, I'm starting to think now that what happened with Jim Chilton was a long time ago, but it really wasn't in the great scheme of things. But, oh gosh, it had to have been in the early 2000s. I can't even remember when it was. But at some point, a rancher in Arizona by the name of Jim Chilton was having a lot of trouble with the Center for Biological Diversity. They were squeaking in on the grazing allotment that he had and the ranch that his family was running cattle on. And they were taking pictures and showing the public and everybody else on their website what a terrible rancher he was and how he was overgrazing and this and that and the other. And well, Jim just decided he wasn't going to put up with it anymore, and he filed a lawsuit against him for malicious libel. And Howard Hutchinson was involved with that one again. And that Howard, of course, as everyone knows, is the executive director of the Arizona-New Mexico Coalition of Counties. And he did a lot of the background research on what was going on and why the center was doing what they were doing to Mr. Chilton. And what they found out was that Jim's allotment had a get-together on it from these same folks, and they had made a big old dirt lot out of one of his pastures, and then they went and took pictures of the dirt lot that they had created, and then they said it was his overgrazing. And he was able to prove that eventually. We found photographs on the internet of what they had done, that they had shown where they'd had their little get-together and how proud they were of it. And then when Jim sued him, they took it all off the internet, but we were able to go through all the website history and find all of that stuff. And Jim was able to use that in that lawsuit. And those people were finally convicted of something that they have done for years and years and years, which was the conviction was malicious libel against a rancher in Arizona. So he won that case and is really kind of inspiring, but the rest of us don't really always get to go to court.
Right. And what's something about this is the Center for Biodiversity, I don't know how many lawsuits they give to the Forest Service against us ranchers. And here is their history of where they altered the pictures to change the facts. And the Forest Service listens to them. It's just amazing. And then, Laura, you said that somebody contacted you from another state, and they said that their Forest Service was actually fighting for the ranchers.
Right. Another state, a northern state, who shall be nameless. I was talking to a gentleman about another lawsuit filed against the Forest Service trying to remove grazing. And he said that their regional offices of the Forest Service were fighting the lawsuit tooth and nail. And I thought, How did that happen? How are they fighting it? And our Region 3 doesn't fight these lawsuits that are so frivolous and so destructive to our little communities. Why are we in this boat to where we have a Forest Service that isn't interested in protecting our interests and giving us the protection we need to continue our businesses and protecting the community's economy in these forests? How does that happen?
Yeah, and so that's the whole purpose of our podcast is we need to demand the Forest Service protect the livestock industry. It's actually a law that our grazing fee pays for the protection. We're not making this up. So through this podcast today, we're going to talk about the history of the grazing permit and how it came about. So before we start on that, you wanted to give the website.
Well, this week, since there's so many little aspects to having a podcast, we have a host that hosts the podcast, and they provide us a little podcast website. And we've been, you know, kind of sporadically spreading it around Facebook. But this week I created a Facebook page called Cow Dust and Cattle Country. So you can find links to the shows on that page, and you can message us from there or email us from there and just have a little catch-all if you're a big Facebook user. So you can do that. And if you want to email us directly, it's wildcowtrails@gmail.com. If you want to be on our little show or give us a story idea, email us and we'll get with you and make that happen.
That sounds good. So I hope people send in some information. I know that a lady sent me some or talked to me about some information over in the blue. But before we get to that, Laura, you want to review the purpose of the creation of the National Forest just real quick from that task force report that you found?
Okay. And to give you guys a lot of context that what you wouldn't otherwise get because you're not going to get it from the Forest Service. So wilderness defined in the Wilderness Act of 1964 defines the wilderness as followed. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. An area of wilderness is further defined to mean, in this act, an area of undeveloped federal land retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent improvements or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions.
And we're going to repeat again what we repeated in the last one. Aldo Leopold himself said that the ranches did not interfere with the wilderness. He said that a few frontier ranches add to the ambience of the wilderness. And as it specifically says in the Wilderness Act of 1964, the livestock industry is to remain. So this idea of removing us not only breaks the law, it also interferes with how Aldo Leopold saw the use of the wilderness itself.
Right. What really dumbfounds me is you go to look for those kinds of quotes from Aldo Leopold on a Google search or any other search engine, and you can't find them because search engines are overwhelmed with all of the ecologically PC quotes that Leopold has out there in writing, and every environmental group in the country uses every single PC quote that Aldo Leopold ever used. And so they're at the top of the search engines. So you're not going to find any of the pro-use, pro-grazing, pro-timber, pro-proper management of the land that Aldo Leopold advocated for, because all of these other things are given top billing.
Well, you can find it on rancherhaverights.com.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, you sure can. Thank goodness Carolyn's got her little act together and she's making this available, because it's getting harder and harder to find the reality of what was intended out here.
That's right. And Laura told me that I could put a search engine on my website, and I didn't know that. And that'll help because I'm getting more information and it's harder to find exactly what you're looking for, but maybe
once you get that figured out, that'll help you a whole lot to keep things, you know, to where you need to access it quickly. It'll help your users too.
Yeah, that's what I want. So I was going to tell you a story of Sewell Goodwin. He's a rancher that he passed away a few years ago.
He was actually a pretty good friend of mine when I first got started in grazing associations and stuff. He was a real sweet guy.
He was a heck of a lion hunter. He's known for that. But he had the triple X allotment down on the Blue in the wilderness. And Forest Service went and they made it so he couldn't graze his cattle along the river. It's basically putting him out of business. So listen to this. After the Forest Service turns around, they cancel part of the use of his allotment, and then they offer him money for his deeded. And they don't offer it as a value of the entire ranch. It's the value without the allotment. So people in those offices had to know he was taking a loss. Why didn't they stand up for him? Where was the protection? Where's the oath of office?
Well, you know, that's what's known as creating a willing seller.
Yeah.
Make it to where he can't make a living, and then you go in and try and offer him half price for what he has created and what he has grown in the business he's developed. And, you know, then you can go in there and get his deed of land and add it to more of the wilderness coffers so that you can have something more to burn down later on, I guess. I don't know. Just a quick review of the purpose of the creation of the National Forest from the Range Improvement Task Force Report 83. The principal industries of the Gila National Forest are mining and stock raising. The forest area, 1,638,053 acres, can safely carry about 56,055 head of cattle and horses and 19,415 head of sheep and goats. This is approximately the number now grazed by the forest by 172 permittees, and it may be continued indefinitely without danger to the forest growth and to the watershed values from overgrazing, because sound principles of range management, the result of many years of intensive study, are being put into effect on the National Forest. The carrying capacity of the different ranges is being closely approximated. Although the ranges are fully utilized, they are not overgrazed.
Laura, how many years ago was that written, and how many permittees are there now?
At last count, we had 89 permittees.
That's half. Half of what was supposed to be in there.
Right. That's because they removed all the wilderness allotments.
Well, I'm going to add that I have some newspaper articles of range studies from the early 1900s. And it was a big deal. Today we take it for granted, fences and controlling what cattle into the range. But back in the early 1900s, that was part of the science that they were doing to establish the carrying capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the grazing permit is all about. The grazing permit is not to control us. It is to keep other people's cattle out. They are to protect our use of that range. We're going to be talking about something that was an aha moment for me. The current grazing permit and how it came about.
Okay, yeah, this is your episode.
But first, I talked with a friend who lives in the Blue, the wilderness in Arizona. A lady, her sons will be fifth generation ranchers. And she told me that across the board, the ranchers in the Blue have been cut 78%. I don't know if that was just this year or within the past 5 years. But 78%.
In the last, 30 years, and they're in Region 3 of the U.S. Forest Service as well.
And they aren't being protected, are they?
No.
How do you stay in business?
Well, clearly a lot of people don't. We're seeing the vast majority of ranchers with grazing allotments in the wilderness designation, and they've been targeted for this bankruptcy, and it's just one of those strategies that seems to be prevalent in this region. And it was definitely something that, again, Aldo Leopold did not agree with.
Then when it's said and done, the Forest Service will put in the records the ranchers went broke. And those employees in the Forest Service who know, they move to another district or a state and they get a pay raise. Tell me that isn't true. We've seen it time and time again. Our rangers do not stay with us for over a decade. How many of you had? We've had tons.
Yeah, we've had a lot of rangers. Yeah, I can't even think. I can think of probably five just since I've been on this ranch. But Matt's had a lot of rangers that he's known over the years. But we're the only ones that are the steady, consistent part of this.
That's right. That's, again, going back to ranchers have rights. I list the purpose of the website, and that's to provide information where the Western rancher can turn to ask the question, where is the protection? We demand that we have protection. Most people don't know the history, and so they can't back up those statements, but that's what we're working on today.
So when I started thinking about the regulatory protections, when you started talking about it, this is the protection that I found that the U.S. Forest Service is supposed to be implementing back when the agency wasn't just trying to manage our forest systems as national parks. So from USDA Circular Number 240, this is the most recent one in 1922, this was the U.S. Forest Service regulations for grazing. It went into great detail when highlighting the purpose of the grazing regulations. The purpose of the grazing regulations of the U.S. Forest Service is to produce an equitable distribution of grazing privileges and a permanent grazing industry. In the application,
what industry?
Yeah, permanent. It says that. In the application of these regulations, the interests of the small stockmen are to be amply protected. Sound principles of range management, the result of many years of intensive study, are being put into effect on the national forests. The carrying capacities of the different ranges is being closely approximated. Although the ranges are fully utilized, they are not overgrazed. They are supposed to regulate in such a way as to provide the protection required. Carolyn, we talk a lot about the intent of Congress, which is how federal laws, including those directing the USDA and the U.S. Forest Service and other land management agencies, are supposed to manage under the intent of Congress. Can you confirm that congressional intent is being thwarted? And what have you found that indicates this?
Yes, I can confirm that it is being thwarted. Regulations under which grazing permits are assigned, and this comes from the 1907 use book, small applicants for grazing permits will be given preference in the following order. Small nearby owners, persons living in or close to the reserve, whose stock have regularly grazed upon the reserve, are dependent and who are dependent upon its use. B, all other regular occupants of the reserve range. After Class A, those who live on or in near the reserve have been provided for, the larger nearby owners will be considered, but limited to a number which will not exclude regular occupants whose stock belong or are wintered at a greater distance from the reserve. C, owners of transient stock.
So let me ask a question. So the owners of the transient stock, they had less priority than people who were in holders?
That's right. And that is what the grazing permit was to protect against. They called these transient stock tramp stock.
Okay.
They were just going through an area. They were eating it down. This is where the overgrazing came from. They were eating it down to nothing. And those who had homesteads could not use the range that went along with their homestead. And that is where the federal government was to protect the homesteaders, protect them from the transient stock.
Well, and it stands to reason that the homesteaders who were given priority for a grazing allotment had to protect that allotment to be able to reuse it year after year.
That's right. Yeah, and that is why the grazing permits. The government said, do you want us to protect you, the smaller stockmen, from these range wars? And the ranchers were actually asked that question. Going on, reading about the grazing permit, and this is from a 1905 report on the Public Lands Commission, says at present, the vacant public lands are theoretically open commons, free to all citizens. But as a matter of fact, a large proportion has been parceled out by more or less definite compacts or agreements among the various interests. So those homesteaders have already established their range right. We know that grazing lands are managed under different agencies. Public lands is under Bureau of Land Management. National forests are managed under the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And this is going to repeat, this is from a newspaper article, and it's going to repeat what we read about in the 1906 use book, that who gets first use of the lands. And it says that the horses and cattle of the actual reserve residents be allowed within the reserves for any part or all of the year. Those stock owners who do not own land within the reserve or who live 10 miles away will not be allowed to graze their stock within the reserve. Now, this was written in 1903. The U.S. Forest Service grazing permit didn't come about until 1905, 1906. So right there, giving grazing permits to those who live in the reserves, and they were free.
Again, that shows consistency and that the agency was trying to give priority to the small family rancher who had an in-holding or a homestead within the forest boundaries.
That's right. That is very right. There was supposed to be protection. Let me see. The very first grazing privileges before the U.S. Forest Service created theirs, the very first agreement was the ranchers would agree to extinguish fires.
Oh, can I read that one? Oh, that looks like a neat little... Okay, this is 1902 from the Williams News. Stockmen of all kinds are required to make an application for grazing privileges in which they agree to extinguish fires in the reserve or assist in doing so when they are discovered. Permits are granted on that basis. The people living within the reserve are given the first preference. Settlers owning ranches inside and living outside of the reserve come next, and outside people are given what remains. And that's when they were talking about developing the preference right to use the range, right?
Yes, and all that was required. All they had to agree to do was that they would extinguish fires. And that's another whole other podcast, because about that time, that's when in our area, the junipers started overtaking the ranges, mm-hmm. was when the ranchers no longer could do those small, low-control burns as they did, as the Indians did, as the Spanish did, but the U.S. government said no. The grazing rights were recognized as a privilege. I'm going to read, it says, sheep and cattle to graze on Gila Reserve. And this is from 1904. So this will allow the ranchers in the locality of the reserve the first privilege of grazing rights, which means a great benefit to the sheep and cattlemen of the district.
Hey, I wanted to ask, that was from the El Paso Herald in 1904. You're finding this that long ago in actual clippings from actual news articles explaining how the ranchers were given rights.
That's right. And if you go to my website, Ranchers Have Rights, you can actually tap on the newspaper articles and it will take you to the original newspaper.
And that pretty much defines what Congress intended when they started organizing and regulating the grazing on these lands.
Right. And there was no expense in making applicants or receiving a permit. That changed in 1905 and 1906. But this is from another newspaper article, Twin Falls Weekly, 1905. Grazing privilege and forest reserve so patterned that small stockmen are given preference and transient stockmen, the tramp herds, are placed at the bottom of the list. So once again, that telling the ranchers that they have rights if they have a homestead.
Okay. Yep. No, it actually makes perfect sense.
Yes. 1904, in another newspaper article, it says that the range rights of present users as determined by priority of occupancy and present use shall be carefully safeguarded. No sudden or stringent upheaval which would cause commercial distress. There was an implied assurance from the government that the homesteaders would have protection.
That's pretty consistent across the board from papers all over the country.
Right. And this one's from the Lancaster Examiner, 1905. The best use of the public grazing land requires the careful examination and classification of these lands in order to give each settler land enough to support his family. So people coming out from the east, they hear that we have thousands of acres attached on our allotment, attached to our homestead, attached to our deeded land. It was Theodore Roosevelt who said, the best use of the public grazing land requires the careful examination and classification of these lands in order to give each settler land enough to support his family, following the general policy already in successful operation on the forest reserves. Right there, that says that the allotment is tied to our deeded land and that it is supposed to be enough to support a family. What does that mean to you, Laura, when you hear that? I mean, that's so obvious.
I'm just kind of slack-jawed that they can interpret it any other way.
Over time, they've just been changing things over time.
Right.
And the grazing permits, they were for protection of the smaller stockmen. They were to prevent monopoly of the range. You want to read that next article?
Sure. Hang on. In order to avoid a monopoly of grazing privileges upon both reserves, a maximum of 1,500 head of cattle and horses or 6,000 head of sheep will be established, and no person, partnership, or corporation will be allowed a permit for more than this number of stock.
Because I know ranchers up the road from here had 10,000 head of cattle, and mm-hmm. they owned miles and miles and miles. The smaller stockmen, it took away his range rights.
Right.
And so there,
because
they're,
the bigger you were, the more you could take over and the more you could push other people who were trying to settle and make a life in a home under the Stock Raising Homestead Act and the Homestead Act, you could kind of push them out of the way and make room for your great big herd. And so it looks to me like the Forest Service was trying to get some control over the larger stockmen as well. And that in turn prevented big overgrazing problems.
It definitely stopped the range wars.
Yeah.
When they got rid of the monopolies. And you know, I feel, you know, it's not about feelings, but it's too bad for the big ranchers who were providing jobs for lots of families.
Well, you know what I think is interesting is, you know, when we did our whole title change search, you know what I found out about our little place here? It was part of a great big outfit, and it was called the Red River Cattle Company. And it was, my gosh, I can't even remember exactly what years it was, but I think it started in the 1880s and it went through to like 1910. And all of the, what are the now the neighboring allotments where our neighbors live and all of the wilderness belonged to the Red River Cattle Company. And when the allotment boundaries started being delineated and the little permits started taking place, they broke that Red River Cattle Company up and gave those allotments to the people who had inholdings instead of that great big conglomerate that was based out of Colorado. But one thing that these guys that ran hundreds of thousands of cattle throughout the West did was they solidified the stock watering rights, because they were what these ranches were based off of is the stock watering rights. And so one of the documents I found was where the Red River Cattle Company mortgaged the springs all throughout the Aldo Leopold and the Gila and the Black Range. And that was a document that's still to this day in our chain of title.
Absolutely. In our area, it was the WS Ranch. And from what I can tell, there were 11 ranches that were created after the WS downsized. And again, I'm doing research like you did, because the WS being here, they came 1890s, 1880s, they established the water rights, as you said, and the water rights are a state issue.
Right.
The next newspaper article, to protect permittees who may wish to dispose of their property against the losses which sacrifice sales would involve, it has been customary to allow continued use of the National Forest Rangers by the new owner. So I could sell you my homestead. The Forest Service would recognize that. I could not sell you my permit.
But
it's kind of talking
the permit
in circles.
Is attached to the homestead.
The permit is a promise,
yes,
that the Forest Service will protect us.
Right. The allotment is attached to the homestead.
The allotment is attached to the homestead. The permit is the Forest Service saying, yeah, we'll protect you, although it's been changed over the years. What if we end with this letter from Theodore Roosevelt?
Okay, go ahead.
Why don't you read that?
Oh, yay. Let me get it big enough so I can see it. So from the Twin Falls Weekly News, December 29th, 1905, there's a letter from Theodore Roosevelt, and it says this: My dear Mr. Secretary, I have received your letter. Our effort is to keep the grazing lands of the forest reserves for the use of the stockmen, especially the small stockmen who actually live in the neighborhood of the reserves. To prevent waste and destruction of the reserves and to keep them so that they can be permanently used by the stockmen, no less than by the public. To prevent the waste and destruction of the reserves and to keep them so that they can be permanently used by the stockmen, no less than by the public, you have to spend a certain amount of money. Part of this money is to be obtained by charging a small fee for each head of stock pastured on the reserve. Less than a third of the actual value of the grazing is at present charged, and is, of course, perfectly obvious that the man who pastures his stock should pay something for the preservation of that pasture. He gets all the benefit of the pasture, and he pays for its use, but a small fraction of the value of that is to him, and his money is in reality returned to him, because it is used in keeping the forest reserve permanently available for use. This is in accordance with the steady policy of your department as regards the western lands, to which is to favor in every way the actual settler, the actual homemaker, the man who himself tills the soil or himself rears and cares for his small herd of cattle. Sincerely yours, Theodore Roosevelt. I got a frog in my throat.
This is such an important letter. This is a letter stating that we pay the Forest Service to protect the small stockmen.
Mm-hmm.
We are paying for protection. It is the Forest Service who should be fighting against having wolves killing our livestock. It is the Forest Service that is saying, no, we're not going to close off these pastures for a frog. We will work with the stockmen. The stockmen take care of the land. They do believe in conservation. We will work with them.
Just another example of how the Endangered Species Act, even though it doesn't really protect species, it's just being used as a whipping tool to undermine all old established regulatory protections for people.
That is right.
Well, one thing I've noticed through all of this discussion that we've had here today is that there are a lot of P words.
Popcorn.
I hope someone out there has popcorn, because I think I'm being boring today. But of all the P words, I've noticed that the word preference comes up a lot. And the legal definition of preference is favor shown to one person or thing over another or others. Now, they specifically say throughout all of these regulations and all of these laws that the ranchers have a preference to be out here. The next P word I'm going to talk about real quick is priority. That's in a lot of the regulatory documentation. And that means the right to take precedence or to proceed before others. And then, of course, there's the word privilege, which I think is being defined improperly by a lot of people. And that legal definition is a special right, advantage, or immunity granted or available only to a particular person or group. And they say that we have the privilege out here. But there's a lot of people who define privilege as being something that can be taken away. And yet a special right or advantage is not, under anyone's definition, something that should be removed. Not to mention permanent. The word permanence has been put in a lot of these regulations that have been written by the Forest Service over the years. They were instructed by Congress, by the President of the United States, by all of the old Interior Secretaries to ensure that the youth stockmen out here were given permanence. The last P word is permit, which is an official document giving someone authorization to do something. But what are our paper permits subject to when you've signed your permit? What does it say at the bottom of it, Carolyn?
It says valid existing rights. It's outlined in the first P's, rights which we ranchers must recognize under the Mining Act and ranch-related rights of way and water rights and surface rights, which are also recognized under this permit, right there in writing.
Right. Sign ours, it says subject to valid existing rights, and we sign that thing understanding that when we go into a management agreement for the year with the Forest Service, that they will respect our valid existing rights under those earlier P words, and that we will respect the rights of others that also have some right on the surface estate to access or anything else.
What's confusing is I sent in a letter to a Forest Service supervisor asking, what are the valid existing rights? If our permit says we have to recognize valid existing rights, what are those? It should be written down on a cue card somewhere. The whole office was stumped.
They don't know.
The one thing they found was in a state hunting book. They found that we had water rights and that people must respect those. The Forest Service didn't have anything, and I eventually got a letter that said there are no rights attached to a permit.
Well, that's because the permit's a piece of paper. But there are, according to the P's, there are rights to the actual grazing allotment.
To the homestead, not to that piece of paper. That piece of paper is for protection. Hey, that's another P. Was that in there?
So how many P's do we have now? We've got preference, priority, privilege, protection, and permit.
That's right. And I would like to talk a little bit about the privilege.
Go ahead.
As privilege are granted through Congress. We have rights that are granted through the Constitution, inalienable rights. Privileges are granted through Congress. And I did a search to find what are privileges. And there was a court case, and it said some of the privileges that we have are protection on high seas, or we have the right to petition. That's a privilege. The right to go from state to state. That's a privilege. The right to enter public lands. Everyone has the privilege to enter public lands, but few own the interest within. And what's interesting, in 1884, so this was after the Civil War, there was a man who wanted to homestead, and his neighbors did not like the color of his skin. And so they chased him off with guns and would not let him make a homestead or a home. Well, the U.S. came in and they protected that man. And I thought, oh, they'll protect him under the Civil Rights Act, under the Civil Rights, what is it, the 17th Amendment. They'll use that. But no, they protected him under the 14th Amendment, the right to property. And that is where our right to enter public lands come in. The Forest Service is supposed to protect that privilege of entering public lands. And for those who have the interest within, they are to be protected.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
There's what you think is a racial argument right there. And yet they made it about the property because this man had every right to enter the forest reserves under the 14th Amendment. And it had nothing to do with, I mean, the protection they afforded him had nothing to do with color of his skin. It had to do with the fact that he had proved up on that property.
That's right. And that was U.S. versus Waddell, WADDELL, 1884. And that's where our rights to enter public lands have been fought in court. I can name another court case too, but I'll do that another time.
Okay. Well, it sounds to me like the word privilege does not mean a revocable, I don't know, like, you know, when your parents took away the car keys because you were naughty, they tell you that driving's a privilege. That's not the same definition that we're seeing here outlined in federal law, federal regulation, legal dictionaries. That is not the same meaning at all.
No, or we get the Forest Service is letting us graze our cattle out there. That's not the definition of privilege.
No, privilege.
We have rights that are tied to our homesteads, our deeded lands.
Right. It's pretty clear there. It says privilege means a special right advantage or immunity granted and available only to a particular person or group. And in this case, it is a privilege, which is a right granted to the inholders of homesteads within the forest boundaries.
That is true. And Angus McIntosh used to say, when something is granted by Congress, it cannot be taken away. It could be paid for. So if your permit or your allotment is taken from you, he is saying it has been granted by Congress. You need to have money compensated for that removal. So I believe that if the Forest Service takes away the use of your allotment, you should still be able to sell your deeded land with the value of the ranch. Because the allotments were not meant to be removed, the cattle removed from them, because the science has already gone into establishing what is a healthy number of cattle to run on these ranges. Cattle were to be permanent, not removed.
Well, and another, as an another aside, when they do decide to go in there and revoke a grazing allotment and take it away and disallow the use of it as defined in the range regulations and the prior existing rights, they're supposed to compensate. It's pretty clear throughout the Fifth Amendment, you're supposed to be able to be compensated for revocation of any of your rights.
I figure it like this, that we buy a ranch to give to our children and then to the next generation. I think if they were to take away an allotment from us, they're taking it away from my children, my grandchildren. So they need to be continually paid. It's not a one-time payment. That's a whole other broader issue. But the people who came out here to homestead came out here to settle. They were told by the government that they would be protected and that the grazing fee would pay for that protection. And we were to have it for permanent, generation after generation. The Forest Service should be protecting us. We should be out doing our jobs right now, working on the ranches, taking care of our home. But instead, we're doing the Forest Service job because the lawyers are not following what Congress has said.
Right, particularly in Region 3. I'm still just dumbfounded that other forest regions are fighting for the rights of the people that use their forest system lands like they're supposed to be doing. And yet in here in Region 3, we don't see that.
I remember talking to a man who worked for the Forest Service, and he said that when he came here, it was totally different than what he saw in other regions where the Forest Service was working with the ranchers, was working with the recreation, was working with the timber.
Well, I don't know what the problem is.
What are we doing here?
I don't really know what the problem is, because I do know that in our ranger district, in the Black Range, we have a really good relationship with that batch of people that are operating out of the Black Range. But I know that also, I know that the Silver City District, which is the head district for all of the districts, calls the Black Range the dark side.
Uh-oh.
Well, so obviously there's a bit of a toot out of the Silver City District.
I'm going to say that when we first came here, the Glenwood District was pretty rough. It was pretty rough on the ranchers.
I guess it just depends on your ranger, what he has to do to maintain approval of the actual region.
Supervisor, yes.
Yeah, and the our politics. The politics and the lawsuits and the sue and settlers. So we have a lot of things we have to deal with.
The main issue is we need the livestock industry is to be protected. We don't overgraze the land. We use the land so that the next generation can use it as well. We're taking grasses, turning it into natural protein. Those who like organic foods, most of our cattle, if we would do the paperwork, would be organic. Finish them off with grass hay, we can. Or we can finish them off with corn silage. But those cattle out there are free-ranging and are healthy and are part of the environment.
Well, and one of the things that people don't consider when they talk about why there are ranches in these kinds of lands is the fact that there's a lot of mountainous regions, and those mountainous regions lend themselves to water, and that lends itself to having good grass year-round.
And that's right. And in the wintertime, our cattle go down into the canyons, and they eat the brush. And so what are they doing? They're preventing fires by trimming down the trees and the brush that would overtake the land. It's just part of a natural cycle that's been established maybe 500 years.
Another benefit to having these ranches that are stable and doing well is a homeland security benefit. This is a nice, open, remote type of situation that would keep things pretty safe for providing beef.
Yes, and what's stopping that is groups of people that are intentionally putting out something that will harm our industry. Well, and the Forest Service is to protect us.
Yeah, they're supposed to be protecting us, but they don't seem to want to do that, particularly in this region. And we're dealing with suing and settling under the Endangered Species Act mostly. And our little small family ranchers, who are exactly the same type of people as we were 100 years ago when all of these regulations were put into place to protect us, we're no different than we used to be. There are very few large corporate ranchers out in the National Forest System lands. Very few, if any.
So we had a story about a lady who came out here homesteading, and I don't see it on this, on the end of our notes.
I don't see
it either. Can we find that again?
Let me see if I can find it. It was a good one. I was excited about it. I found it. Okay.
Okay, you'll have to read it because I don't have it.
Okay, it's on my Facebook page. So the National Ranching Heritage Center has a little story about Jessica McMillan. After disembarking Ellis Island in 1902, 30-year-old Jessica McMillan bought her first six-shooter in New York before traveling alone to the New Mexico Sacramento Mountains to settle a homestead claim. The native Scott was a long way from the lush countryside of her youth, but nevertheless, she forged ahead in carving a life for herself. At a time when most young women were choosing to marry and start families, Jessie chose to become a single female homesteader. Her privileged upbringing at European boarding schools did nothing to deter her. She proved up on her claim, introduced her first alfalfa crop to the area, rode many, many miles on her horse, Wee Boy, to tutor local ranch children. By 1907, she received title to her land, which was, by all estimates, incredibly productive. At the age of 83, she married Loftus Farrington, but only after independently accomplishing her long-held dream of owning an American ranch. What do you think of that?
I think she came out as a homesteader. She knew that her cows could range out on the range, and she did exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
And that is what a good way to end.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I like it. And there's a picture over here with her horse, Wee Boy, and her cabin. It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
This is another little National Women's History Month article. And what amazes me is we've been in ranching for a really long time, and it really is conducive to protecting women and women's rights. And if women wanted to do something, they could sure do it. There is nobody telling them they can't. So women may have been depressed in other aspects of pioneer days, but not in ranching, because every hand counts in ranching.
Yeah, I have on my Ranchers Have Rights, I have an article of the law that says the woman could own an allotment. So, yes, ranching was ahead of its time.
You know, my grandmother had a homestead in Mule Creek.
Oh, yeah?
I wish it was still in our family, but yeah, she had a homestead on Mule Creek.
Yeah. I'll be darned, that's where my son ranches.
Good.
So
maybe your son has
that.
My grandmother's old ranch and homestead.
There we go.
Keeping it in the family, man.
There we go. Among Friends. We are now available on Amazon Music, Spotify, and iHeartRadio.
Okay, Apple Podcast is being a little bit quirky. It says we're on it, but I can't find it. But we are on a bunch more podcast hosts. So if you can't find us on Apple, maybe you can find us on another one. Spotify is pretty good. Google Podcast has us. If you want to get in touch with us and you have an episode idea that you want to be covered, contact us by email at wildcowtrails@gmail.com. We have one submission idea so far, and we'll get to that in the upcoming weeks. But if you want to read through the actual will of Congress as it relates to ranching on federal land, be sure and check out ranchershaverights.com for more information.
Yes, thank you, Laura. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. Remember, ranchers have rights. See you on down the road on cow dust and cattle country.